Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote and this is Talking Australia. Today, I'm speaking with Kamilaroi water scientist Bradley Mogridge. Bradley is determined to integrate Indigenous knowledge of water with Western sciences to better understand and manage Australia's precious water sources. Bradley is outspoken about the many ways Australia's water has been mismanaged over the years, but has spent much of his life working on solutions. So I'm really excited to be chatting to him today on this episode of Talking Australia. Bradley, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast today. Now, when it comes to studying water, tell me where your story began.
Well, it was about 65,000 years ago. I drank it from a young age. I swam in it. I loved it. And I think the water, passion for water was more about a passion for protecting water and protecting the stories that connect to that, those water places. So being a science trained, but, you know, having Kamilaroi, which is Northwest New South Wales heritage, really connected to me to country, but also water. And in Kamilaroi language, it's Gali, G-A-L-I. And I found that where my country sits in the Australian landscape is round the bottom end of the Great Artesian Basin, you know, potentially one of the largest aquifers. And, you know, some of the water in that is, you know, our old people called it, you know, ancient water, old water, and, you know, I think they had an inkling that it was old water, but, you know, I think they've done some studies on isotopes, and it's around 2 million years old, you know, from recharge to discharge at the bottom end. And, you know, so that wow. sort of place, that those sort of water places, you know, those natural springs, you know, in my country, you know, you punch a hole in the ground in certain parts and, you know, you'll have a bore that will just keep pumping out hot water. That's sort of like it's on tap. And I think that got to the point where our people knew it was important. But when obviously things changed as the frontier moved across the landscape, you know, they were just puncturing holes everywhere and water was just flowing in open drains. And, you know, then springs started to lose their hydraulic head, which is, you know, their source and their let's say their flow rates, and, you know, that was affecting Kamilaroi people. So I went down a path of science from school, and, you know, I think it started probably, let's say, with a Ducks of Geology at high school in the HSC, my school, and in the late 80s, and moved to science straight out of school. And then I was doing geology, which didn't really connect. I connected with, I love learning about the earth. That really excited me. And some of the things you see, you learn in theory and then you see it in the field is really cool.
I read in your Guardian article that you changed from geology to environmental science at university when undertaking exploration for uranium on someone else's country and in a national park, which you said proved a moral dilemma. Was that a big turning point for you?
Yeah. I was doing a Bachelor of Science at UTS and looking for uranium in a national park on someone else's country in the Western Desert. And I just come home and said, that doesn't feel right. And that was the switch to environmental science. So I think it was probably the right decision at the right time. I don't think I could have gone down that career pathway, but more about thinking about where I could have my impact best. And I think environmental science was a good choice, and that change led me down this new pathway. And, you know, working after doing the Bachelor of Science, environmental science, in local government, New South Wales EPA or Environmental Protection Authority, and then moved, then decided to do a master's in groundwater because I knew groundwater was important. So that's hydrogeology is the professional name, but it's, you know, it's a study of water under the ground. And, you know, we're a small but, I suppose, connected society, you know, very specialised. And I think the connection Aboriginal people have with groundwater is pretty much unexplored. And, you know, part of my master's thesis was looking at that relationship. So, you know, that really...
And when you were exploring that, what did you sort of find?
Well, I found that Aboriginal people and groundwater wasn't a thing. You know, it wasn't in any literature. You know, there's a few stories here and there that I found. There was only sort of regional studies happening. There was no national study per se, because I was in New South Wales at the time. I was studying in New South Wales. I was looking at a New South Wales picture, and yeah, there was nothing really to identify Aboriginal people's relationship with water, and that in a regulated system. Now that they have in New South Wales, where water is a commodity, the aspect of Aboriginal people's ownership of groundwater was very limited also. And because there's no identifier in licensing of water ownership. So, you know, you probably had to, back in the day, you would have had to get an approval. And then there's obviously privacy issues because these are people's names as part of that. So it wasn't hard. So I started a national picture and looking at studies that have been done around the place and looking back at, you know, some of the early accounts from missionaries and surveyors and explorers and frontier people that were engaging with, sometimes nicely, with Aboriginal people across the landscapes and, you know, some of their observations. And, you know, I think Bruce Pascoe's brought out a lot of those observations as well, in his Dark Emu book. And it was really along those lines of looking at what relationship Aboriginal people had with groundwater. And, you know, when you have a continent that is the driest inhabited continent on Earth, you've got 70%, you know, semi-arid. You've got some really tough places on the in the landscape, and knowledge of water was the key to survival. And, you know, these people that... that lived in some of the harshest places on Earth had to know when and where to find water to survive. And, you know, as I delve deeper, you know, it comes even more clearer that their relationship was crucial, I suppose, and the knowledge of their country and the stories, the Dreamtime stories, the law that they put in place to protect these water places. You know, natural springs in a desert environment is a priority to protect, and to know that if you go to that place, water could be found. And some of the things I found was, you know, the using natural indicators to identify groundwater sources in cave systems or springs or shallow aquifers. You might have a huge stand of eucalyptus trees in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, potentially if you dug a bit, you could actually find a shallow aquifer because those trees are accessing that groundwater. Or there was in the 60s, I found an anthropologist had been engaging with the Pintubi mob and in Central Australia, and what they'd found was one of the old men that the anthropologist was engaging with and learning his language and some of them, you know, they'd built a relationship, and what he'd, at the end of their time, I think it was 1964 from memory, and what the old man gave him was a spear thrower, which is a long sort of propulsion mechanism for throwing the spear straighter and faster and harder. And on the back, he'd carved 50-odd concentric circles, and every concentric circle had a traditional name, and those traditional names linked to that place. And what it was, this old man had given him like a GIS layer of all the water holes in this man's country, which is desert. And so, you know, that sort of knowledge existed for survival. And, you know, that was really, really exciting. And I suppose what I've been trying to do over, you know, that was early 2000s when I produced that thesis. And from then, you know, it's all about celebrating that knowledge of what Aboriginal people can offer in the water space because, you know, as I said, it's a dry continent and people have survived for tens of thousands, you know, 65,000 years, maybe longer. And, you know, all the stories, the Dreamtime stories suggest time immemorial. And I think that's the exciting bit, is that we have something to offer in the way we manage water. And, you know, that's been my fight for the last 20-odd years to raise the profile of Indigenous knowledge on water, but also celebrate that knowledge in a way that can actually influence the way we manage water.
And as a water scientist and a Kamilaroi man, obviously you're very determined to integrate that Indigenous knowledge with, hydrogeology sciences. I'm wondering, what does that look like to you, integrating those two things?
Oh, it's baby steps at the moment. The challenge is that, as I sort of mentioned before, that Aboriginal knowledge of water is not celebrated. It's not normalised. It's not part of the curricula. And I suppose that's the other challenge is bringing that knowledge into the curricula and making it normal. You know, like my eldest, my son, he's in year 11 and he has to do Aboriginal studies as an elective. It's not core learning. My daughter's in year 7 and, you know, I'd love to, you know, that Aboriginal studies is a subject, you know, that they can actually do, you know, it's part of the core curricula. And I think it's starting at those young ages and even in primary school. You know, my wife's in early childhood and, you know, she does what she can to bring in that, you know, bringing elders, but also teaching some of those stories that are thousands of years of observations of one's country and testing that environment, you know, that knowledge is a science. It's not, and I suppose it's flipping, I don't know, let's say the paradigm from storytellers and mumbo jumbo and myth and legend and folklore to a set of knowledge that can actually be meaningful to manage country, because the last 200 odd years, Australia in its context hasn't managed country that well. You know, we've seen droughts after drought. You know, these last two big droughts we've had in the last 20 years. You know, they talk about a drought every 40 years. We've had two massive droughts, worst on record, let's say, that's been reported, the Millennium Drought and the last mega drought, created, you know, severe issues. And I suppose the way we manage water was really exposed when we had those massive fish kills in the Lower Darling, two of them. And then you had two independent scientific bodies review why those massive fish kills happened, and not one Indigenous person was a member of those panels. And I suppose that's the thing, that the cultural shift of science needs to evolve as well. And, you know, like, we don't have any Indigenous people as members of fellows of the Academy of Science or fellows of the Australian Technology, Science and Engineering Academy, you know. So we do have Indigenous members of the Academy of Social Science. But, you know, I suppose for the hardcore science, yeah, we don't have any Indigenous people. But, you know, one day Indigenous knowledge would be taught in schools, it'd be normal, you know what I mean? Like, the way Maori knowledge and language is taught in New Zealand, you know, that's something to strive for. You know, they do it well. Non-Maori people know Maori language, you know. I suppose they're lucky in a way, but they have a similar language, a dialect that everyone can learn, whereas Australia, we have that diversity of 250-plus languages that are all different in the way they're spoken and meaning. So that would be a challenge, you know, but I'm on Ngunnawal country in Canberra here, and, you know, if my kids learnt Ngunnawal, that'd be a great thing. But I'd love them to learn Kamilaroi language, which is a challenge because, you know, we're about 900 k's away from country at the moment. But, you know, I think Indigenous knowledge would be front and centre. It wouldn't be an elective. And then the challenge would be also to Indigenise the university curriculum, you know, that Indigenous knowledge and methodologies are throughout are throughout that as well. You know, that's a way to go for the university sector. And I think if that is a future, then I think that'd be a good future, because that people would be equipped with some of the oldest knowledge on the planet. And I think that's cool.
And I just want to go back to something you mentioned. Obviously, the Murray-Darling fish kills was kind of like one of the biggest stories from the past 3 years. And it's a big mismanagement story as well. But I'm wondering, how did you feel when those fish kills started occurring?
Some parts of me sort of said, see, I told you. But some part of me was crushed, you know, like when you think about some of those fish, like the gudu in our language is the Murray cod, thagay is the yellow belly or the callop, and some of those fish are people's totems. They have a direct connection to that species, to protect that species, and to see those fish floating belly up would have been heartbreaking for those people. But then you also think beyond that connection, that's, you know, that human to species connection, but you've also got the spiritual connection to those fish, where, you know, Pondi down further south in that Njeri country is a creation spirit, you know. So there's really strong connection to these fish species, but also, you know, that they are a food source. You know, that if you take away that food source, then the mob are going to go and buy flake from the fish and chip shops, or hake, or whatever it's called, flake, I think it's called, isn't it? You know, which is not what they're used to, you know, and the kids then can't go catch fish. You know, they might start playing up because they don't have that outlet to go and catch fish for the family or for uncles and aunties. And, you know, so I suppose the connection Aboriginal people have with those species that were floating is multi-tiered, but it also exposed how we are not engaged in this space. And, you know, after that, there was the federal government threw some money at a review of native fish recovery, and, you know, there was a number of panels brought up, and I was lucky to sit on the scientific part of the native fish recovery strategy, and, you know, I think that's being considered by ministerial council this week. So, you know, there's Indigenous voices strongly in that, because there was a cultural advisory group set up as well as part of that. So, but the challenge was that Indigenous people weren't seen as experts when these two independent scientific committees were part of it. And, you know, you read Uncle Badger Bates' submission to the Royal Commission, South Australian Royal Commission into the Murray-Darling Basin. You know, he provides a lot of scientific evidence which is based in Aboriginal lore and knowledge. But he would be seen as a storyteller, and that's the thing that needs to change to our path to impact to better manage country, I believe.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. In 2017, you published a paper that basically talked about Indigenous water policy and the impacts of the political cycle. What did that analysis kind of find, and how does that lead into conversations around the management of the Murray-Darling
Basin? Yeah, look, I had two uncles that were in Aboriginal affairs a long time, and they're now passed now, but, you know, they always said governments will come and go and government ideas will impact you, and those cycles of government will change. And even though you might have the best process, the best product, the best output, if a government or leadership changes, they will change it to suit them. And unfortunately, a lot of Aboriginal programs come and go purely because of that. You know, the funding is stopped, a new government comes in, they cut that funding because it was a previous government's funded process, or there's a new leadership. You know, I you know, I've been directly impacted a number of times. You know, it could be a restructure. I do that in inverted commas, and because what a restructure does is really gets rid of a lot of people. That's all it does, and it comes as a cost saving. And I think the challenge I found was that, you know, you had to be resilient enough if a change happened that you were well equipped to be, let's say, educated enough or experienced enough to be successful in the job market if that does come around. You know, so I've had two dream jobs in my career. One was with the national scientific body, and the drought broke in early, you know, the millennium drought broke in 2010-11, and I suppose there was no need for water researchers anymore, and I was an Indigenous water researcher at that time, so I had to find a new job. The second dream job was leading an Aboriginal water unit in New South Wales, and, you know, I wrote another paper in 2019 looking at that, you know, at that experience, and what it was a change in leadership, and that leadership come in to destroy us, but also other planning and policy areas, because, you know, the excuse they used was that we as a team, the Aboriginal Water Initiative, did such a good job in making the department culturally aware. So we had cultural awareness training for the whole department, that they didn't need Aboriginal people anymore. You know, that was the gist of the letter from the secretary. So, you know, things like that, the cycle of change, you know, the National Water Initiative is up for a refresh at the moment. You know, it was signed off in 2004, and that was the first document at a national level that had recognised Indigenous people. And I think that is up for a refresh. It can do better. But the challenge was that the National Water Commission was the agency, the independent agency that had the opportunity to make sure the National Water Initiative was being implemented at a national level. And then under that, you know, there was a First Peoples Water Engagement Council that gave advice to the National Water Commission. And, you know, most of the time the National Water Commission took that advice. But the problem was a new government come in and got rid of the National Water Commission. And obviously that got rid of us as the First Peoples Water Engagement Council. So, you know, these sort of cycles come and go, but we have to be resilient enough to survive those cycles. And, you know, Victoria at the moment has an Aboriginal water unit. They've, you know, the current government and the previous government, which was the same government, they'd promised 9.5 million, I think, from memory, to Indigenous water, the Aboriginal water opportunities. That was building an Aboriginal water unit and also Aboriginal water policy and also Aboriginal water ownership. And so if the government changed at the last election, that program could have been scrapped straight away, you know. So there's continuity is good, but the challenge is surviving that. But also we thought in New South Wales, we thought we were entrenched enough. We're in legislation, we're in gazetted water sharing plans, floodplain management plans. We were key to giving advice on licensing and things like that. So we thought we were well enough entrenched in the system, so they were cornered, so they couldn't get rid of us. But magic red pen come out and we were gone.
How do you deal with those so many ups and downs? And so, like, how do you mentally cope with all of that?
Some days are tough. I think resilience is built in, you know, survival is built in to, that's what I believe, you know, survival is built into Aboriginal people. You know, we will survive. We survived thousands of generations of dry continents. We've survived sea level rise. We've survived volcanism, of volcanic activity. And, you know, those stories exist. And, you know, when the sea level rose in Port Phillip Bay, in Melbourne, there were Aboriginal stories around that, you know, so they've survived droughts, they've survived floods. And I think that being built into us, there is a resilience already built in. And now we're surviving government policy. And I think it's a new enemy at the moment. But I think for me, having an impact, I've been lucky enough to build on a good education. And I'm now in a position where I can actually give people a voice, you know. So a lot of the times through government, through research, I'm the only Aboriginal person in the room sometimes, and you've got to be a voice. I'm not in a position to represent every Aboriginal person, and I'd be kicked out of town if I did that. You know, my work in Aboriginal affairs would be done. I cannot be a voice for Aboriginal people Australia-wide or Torres Strait Islander people. I have to represent my own mob, Kimurui mob, and I have to have approval to say certain things. You know, like for me in groundwater, a lot of groundwater sites in my country are women sites, so I need to be careful of that, you know, so I can't say too much or give away certain information because potentially I'd be getting a slap up the head from the Arnies, you know what I mean? So, or a thong from 50 metres. I think the challenge for me, or my career sort of, I don't know what's the word, when you, this is the way I think and feel, my own way of doing is that I have to have an impact wherever I am. And if I start becoming, or if, as soon as I start becoming impacted by the process, it's time for me to close that door. Or if doors get closed, I always know another one will open. And I think that's, you've got to have that positivity there to know that opportunities will come. But you need to have that experience and knowledge behind you to have that confidence as well. And, you know, like when New South Wales did that to us in late 2016-17, when they've got rid of the Aboriginal Water Initiative, you know, there was staff that were regionally based in towns that weren't, you know, that don't really need water experts. And I had 10 Aboriginal staff and one non-Indigenous staff in my team that were around the whole state, and they engaged in water. And, you know, I couldn't promise them employment forever. You know, that was my dream job, as leading that team. But I saw it coming, and I had to let the team know that this is coming, and I had to actually leave before that decision was made. I knew it was coming, but I gave them the ups that, you know, there's not going to be an Aboriginal Water Initiative in this new structure. And that was true. You know, in early 2017, they brought out the structure. They'd reduced the number of full-time Aboriginal staff, which was against the Aboriginal employment strategy of the state. And also what they'd done was created three positions in three different teams. And, you know, that's the old divide and conquer scenario, that they'd reduced the number of Aboriginal employees, they'd moved them all into different units, and they went to re-advertise all those positions. So, you know, one of the 10 team members got one of those jobs, and, you know, I'd moved on at that stage to do the PhD at Uni Canberra. So, you know, most of the staff that I know of have positions, but the challenge was at that time that, you know, if they were in a regional location, that regional location wasn't looking for a water expert. And, you know, that was really tough. So, but, you know, I had to, throughout the 5 years, you know, we'd made sure that we had a strong training budget, and they could get as much training and advance in that area that they could. So, you know, those sort of things are hard to take, and, you know, speaking about it is like therapy, let's say. But also it's you got to make them accountable as well. Some of those people that made those decisions, you know, part of my role is bringing out that voice and those things we had into the foray. And, you know, I think you know, that they will be accountable one day, but, you know, what they did. And those decisions are happening all the time, and they happen in every sector, no doubt. And, you know, a good program from a previous government is a bad program for a new government or a new leadership. So it's, you know, it's unfortunate, but for me, I've always talked about, or I've always built myself on having an impact. Sort of mentioned before that if I'm having an impact, I'm doing good. And if I'm not making a difference, then it's time to move on. And I think, you know, and it's unfortunate, you know, you shouldn't have to do that. And there are people that survive these changes, and, you know, a lot of the times they aren't Aboriginal people that survive these changes in government or program shifts or defunding. So we hear it all the time, and, you know, that's, it's frustrating, but it's, I think it's built in for us to just be resilient enough to just bounce back.
And I want to go back to something you said earlier about Australia being the driest country on earth, and just this idea that, you know, we already lack water and now climate change is obviously such a huge issue for this continent. I'm wondering, are you optimistic for Australia's future given, you know, everything that we've kind of been speaking about?
Oh, I don't know. I think about my kids' generation and, you know, what are they going to grow up with? What are we going to leave them? And I think that's the legacy issue, is that, you know, do we dig more holes in the ground to pull out coal to actually heat up the atmosphere? I think that is probably a no-brainer. And unfortunately, the way we're heading, we're going to see more and more impact, especially for Indigenous people. Some of these places are going to get drier and hotter. The people in the Torres Strait are going to be, they're already at the forefront of impacts of climate change. You know, we've already had a mammal extinction from climate change, a small rodent, you know. So these little things are starting to happen. And, you know, people in the South Pacific and let's say the Torres Strait as well and coastal regions, they're going to be the first to feel the brunt. And, you know, that sea rising, it's already happening. They're losing country. The tides are getting bigger, and then you've got two mega droughts, one after the other, in southeastern Australia, they're calling them it was the worst on record, and now the next one was the worst on record. So I think, you know, with the hottest year on record, this is the new normal, and it's unknown what that new normal is. And I think Aboriginal people have something to offer that new normal because of the way we've survived on this dry continent, driest inhabited continent on earth. And, you know, I think there's something to provide. And a lot of the times you see climate change scenarios and the future of, you know, what can we do to mitigate? How can we adapt? And I think the aspect of Indigenous knowledge, adapting and mitigating for thousands of generations to the changes in country, are already there. So, you know, I think that's the same for water management, is that, you know, they have the stories that talk about, you know, the water holes that are deep, you know, they call them refugia these days, of the ones where, you know, the native fish and aquatic species living in these dry times. But when you have the whole river dry, what happens then? You know, that's been happening, unfortunately, in too often. And, you know, you see the way we manage water under these scenarios, and climate change is not part of these scenarios. And, you know, these droughts aren't included in current day modelling. And, you know, you'll find that rivers will stop flowing and dry up quicker and faster into the future, no doubt. I have no doubt about that. And what happens is that rules that are set up to manage and share water, let's say in New South Wales, in an unregulated system, they can actually pump water that's in low flow. So when the river's at its lowest flow, people can still pump. That's a rule that was brought in by a previous water minister. And, you know, that's the problem, is that that's the water that's supposed to keep the river alive. But, you know, these guys that are pumping that water aren't breaking the law. They're just complying with the rules. And they're the rules potentially they lobbied for. And that's unfortunate. And those sort of things need to be changed. It's not about the dollar, because water is a commodity, unfortunately. It shouldn't be about the dollar. It's about the value of that water for life. You know, without water, you die. And I suppose country is dying a lot more often because water is mismanaged.
Well, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast with me today, Bradley. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingAustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingAustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.